to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm excited to have Anders Lewelijk on the show today. I hope I said your last name correctly, but you'll introduce yourself. And he's a CEO and co-founder of Focal Point and has spent 20 plus years in procurement, really anxious to talk about how things have changed and where it's going with AI and what you guys are doing. But why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, just like you said, Dean, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, my name is Anders Lewelijk, and I am the founder and CEO of a company called Focal Point. I spent 25 years in procurement and supply chain before I started the company. And it was clear to me that as a practitioner, that we needed a different kind of system, specifically one that consolidated data and consolidated process, because procurement does so much more now than when I started 25 years ago in procurement or 30 years ago in procurement. When I started, it was all about saving money. So taking categories of spend, commoditizing them into the lowest common denominator, bidding it out, saving a bunch of money, life was good. But as regulations started changing and we had supplier failures, then we had Enron and we had GLBA come in and SOX coming in, procurement changed because how people dealt with suppliers changed dramatically. And the technology did not keep up with it. So answering a simple question like how much money am I spending with this supplier could take literally days to figure out because you have multiple ERPs, multiple sources of truth. And that's a relatively simple question. Now ask different questions like what is supplier XYZ's cyber security posture or what is their carbon footprint or what is their diversity and inclusion posture? Like these are real questions that take a lot of time to answer. So we set out to build a solution to solve all of those problems and more.
So I had another question, but you answered it, but maybe I'll ask it anyway. So like at Focal Point, you talk about going from cost-centric to strategic, data-driven asset. And like what leadership behaviors and mindset require to make that shift fully happen?
It's interesting, right? Because a lot of procurement people aren't, let's call them dynamic, right? They're order takers. It's about getting the transaction to the pipeline as quickly as possible. But there's nothing wrong with that, depending on where you are in the journey of building your function. And I sometimes heard from a boss of mine, like no one ever wants procurement to have a perfect procurement operation. Good enough is good enough. It's just, you have to define what good enough is. And I think that that's fair. So a procurement leader needs to take accountability for all of these things, like building diversity and inclusion or carbon footprint or customer experience and all those kinds of things and lead that charge. It's not something that he farms out or he or she farms out to somebody else to manage, right? And taking accountability for the outcomes, but also the customer experience is hugely important because as a former chief procurement officer, I felt like the goalie of the javelin team, right? Because no one really wants to deal with procurement, right? It's not exactly known as a fun function. It's taking accountability for those kinds of things and standing behind it while also driving controls and clarity is very important. Yeah, it's someone who leads from the front and not necessarily gets buried six levels deep in a finance organization.
Yeah, good. And like, how are you seeing AI, data analytics, like really changing the whole procurement process?
Procurement process itself hasn't changed much, right? Because you still have to build requirements, find suppliers, all that kind of stuff, right? But the ability to have things be automated and significantly sped up. And what we say is you want to speed up the tactical so you can focus on the strategic stuff, right? We actually require brain cells to do. For example, you can get pretty damn close to the pin. For example, writing an RFP using Gen AI to come up with relatively good questions is about taking those things and putting them into a format and a structure that you can actually do an effective process that you need procurement to do. But a lot of the tasks that either were done poorly and manually, or maybe not at all, are now being pushed to the forefront. I'll give you an example. So let's say an organization has a really good contract, and that contract says that, for instance, that the organization needs to collect a SOC 2 and a certificate of insurance every year, right? Now, a lot of times for most companies, that doesn't happen at all because procurement or the back-end functions don't have the capacity to chase suppliers down and collect those artifacts. But let's say they do. There's a good chance that those artifacts will never get read and actually evaluated against the criteria that was set forth in the first place. Now, with a system like Focal Point, you can send the alerts to the supplier and say, all right, give me your certificate of insurance and give us your SOC 2. And we can automate the review of those artifacts without any human intervention to say, yeah, it meets the criteria or it doesn't meet the criteria. And then you manage by exception rather than having to do all that stuff manually. So I would say that a lot of the stuff that has been deprioritized because of capacity can now be done and make the organization more safe and secure against third-party exposure, for example. And you can even take that to the next level where you can then say, all right, tell me who your suppliers are doing business with. What are your fourth-party suppliers, if you want to call them that? And there's a lot of stuff you can do now using AI to determine, for example, security posture, bad events, negative news, all those kinds of things without actually having to do a whole lot of work. And this is nirvana for a lot of CISOs out there, right? Because they just don't have the capacity to manage all of these third and fourth parties directly. So it's changing a lot. It's coming up with that standard that's becoming the challenge, right? Because as you can imagine, writing a large language prompt takes skill, it takes context, it takes a lot of the things that need to actually go into that to get a good result back. So you certainly want more false positive than non-reactive negatives.
And as you like automate some of these workflows with AI, like how do you build trust with your system or with your customers, that this happens automatically?
Again, it really depends on the folks that you're interacting with. Some customers come to us and say, look, how much stuff can we possibly throw into AI so we can focus on strategic stuff? And that's all well and good. It becomes a bit more murky is when you start saying, I'm going to outsource or out-task, if you will, a financial function like paying invoices, right? That's terrifying for a finance to say, okay, now I'm going to have a machine read my invoices and code them. So it takes a lot of sort of trust to be built in. And what we tend to do then is build a human in the loop process in to say, look, today you get a PDF invoice, you sit in a side screen, like one screen on the left side, one screen on the right side. You read the invoice on the left and you type the invoice in on the right. It's manual, it takes a long time, but it's relatively accurate, right? But now all of a sudden, you now will have all that done for you automatically. Now the clerks can compare the two side by side, like what the AI read and what the invoice said, and say, all right, yep, that matches and the coding is correct. And as you build more and more trust into the model and say, okay, we processed 2,000 invoices and four of them had a mistake in it, and probably most of those invoices looked a certain way, you can say, okay, invoices that look like this is 100% accurate. We can just process it through. So it's like a crawl, walk, run, but I think you have to show people that this is reliable. And if I'm being really honest, it's probably more reliable than fingers hitting keyboards.
Yeah, no doubt. And how about what kind of advice do you have for leaders? Like when you look at, like what are really important metrics that you should look at running this process versus there's maybe vanity metrics out there?
At the end of the day, I think procurement processes, you have to be both efficient and effective. And by effective, I mean it has to meet the objectives that you set out in the first place. And I think throwing something into AI for the sake of doing it in AI is not necessarily a good gauge. I think as you look at AI and you want to stick your finger in the water, so to speak, I think you want to start with where you have an actual pain point in a repeatable process that can be automated or helped by using AI. And I think that's been good work because there are so many processes in procurement that are highly repetitive that can be and should be automated to the biggest extent. So that would be my advice is start with something where there's an actual pain point rather than just throwing everything into it. Because there's a lot of consultancies out there that says we can automate everything. You probably can, but should you? And if you do that, are you losing effectiveness by focusing purely on efficiency? And I think, again, like I'm an old man, right? So I want to make sure things get done right before quickly. And I think that's where my focus has been with our customers, right? So just because some of our competitors say we can do an 85-point assessment in 3 seconds. And I thought, can you really though? Is that gonna hold up to an audit? Because I've been on the side of audit where it's not so pleasant. And I think this is where people are saying that's too fast, too. And I think you want to be able to crawl, walk, run and really show the effectiveness before you throw everything at it.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good advice. And then how about looking at your own leadership journey? Like you are a former CPO and now you're CEO of a tech platform. Like how has your leadership changed and how has it changed even with AI and data? Like maybe reflect on your own journey.
Yeah, I guess for me, again, having some more miles on it than probably most startup founders, right? I come at things pragmatically to say, let's build robust architecture that can withstand big volumes and complex things rather than getting something to market fast. And maybe to the detriment of the company, if I'm being really honest. I'd rather get it, like I said before, I'd rather get it done right than get it done fast. But what it has done for me in this journey is certainly being able to be vulnerable to say, I don't know this and I need help doing this because otherwise it's probably not going to get done. On this AI journey, there are certain things that I took as just table stakes. I'll give you an example. So a lot of companies out there today say we can do AI or we can use a query for this, that, and the other thing. And they can, but it's generic because they don't have the underlying data to feed those queries. So what we have done from day one was to build that data layer so we know what you spend with a supplier, how many contracts you have with a supplier, how much you spend in a category of spend, who the stakeholders are, how many projects there are. And these are all fantastic context drivers for analysis, right? I thought that was table stakes, but none of my competitors were able to do that. So by putting the actual work into the architecture and the framework that underlies everything, we're actually able to leapfrog things. And that was an aha moment for me as I was looking at the competitive landscape. Yeah, putting the work in at the beginning really helped us build something that wasn't on the forefront 5 years ago when I started the company. But I'm the same guy I was probably 10 years ago from a leadership perspective. I trust people inherently, probably too much, to be honest. I give people a chance to succeed or fail. And we all always take care of our own, especially having people in the Ukraine, as we do. Most of our dev shop is in the Ukraine. And in the Philippines as well. Now we had several typhoons roll over there. So yeah, we take care of our people. It's not always the easiest thing to do, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, good job. And yeah, it's interesting around how you like use data, build context, because that's how you really do improve AI output. And everyone thinks that these models are just smart, but it takes a lot of work to ensure accuracy and the correct answers. And so yeah, good job there by building up all that metadata context and be more performant or more accurate, I should say.
Yeah, and the cool thing is, once you have the data structure in place, you can actually use large language model to improve the data quality as well. If you don't have the structure, if you only rely on the data sitting in all disparate systems, yeah, you can pull them in using an API, but it's going to be a dog's breakfast when you fade it into the large language model. Unless you have the data structure fixed to begin with, it's hard.
More and more things are getting automated, data driven. Like what do you see as like the future for procurement teams? What kind of roles of like human leaders would be maybe in the next 5, 10 years?
It's super interesting to me because I get asked that a lot. Because as you see, McKinsey and Accenture and all these other companies now, you see that the sort of the entry-level positions going into nothing. And it's going to be something in industry in total where it'll be interesting to see how entry-level jobs get filled now because there are so many things that can be done in an automated way. And I would hate to be a graduate right now looking forward to say, okay, what is the landscape going to look like if a lot of these things are going to be outtasked using AI, for example? And it's going to be the same in procurement. I think when I started in procurement, I fell ass backwards into it because who really starts and ends their college and say, okay, I want to go into procurement? Like no one. Or maybe now, but certainly not in my time. But I came in through it through a data thing where I built a database for a procurement organization as it was starting out. But I think you're going to see a lot more entry-level jobs in procurement coming from the business. For example, you probably built up a knowledge in marketing, in marketing inherently, for example. Now I can roll into procurement to lead the process of sourcing marketing or whatever the case may be. And I think that's going to be a big change for procurement because it's not going to be the same amount of entry-level jobs. And I can tell you, right, so a lot of the, when I used to run procurement and facilities management and accounts payable and all these other functions that sort of roll into procurement in some places, a lot of my talent would come through accounts payable or through facilities management into procurement because they prove that they can run a process, they can think analytically, all those kinds of things. And I think, again, as those tasks will become automated, certainly not facilities management, but accounts payable, some of these other fairly data-driven entry-level jobs will become automated to a large extent. So I think it's going to change the landscape significantly.
It's probably not just procurement, but this is a conversation for a lot of departments and skills. Like, how are we going to get the next generation to the level we need if there's no learning period?
And also, it's a great question I don't know the answer to, but also it terrifies me a little bit because I see a lot of young people now will not write an email or send an email to somebody without running it through a large language model to check first, right? And you say, how are these folks going to be able to communicate in a business settings with folks that are 20, 30 years their senior that have that confidence level that you don't need your homework checked before you send it off sort of thing? The power distance is going to be significant, I think, right? Because you can't hide behind a keyboard in a boardroom setting, for example, or in a management setting.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a very interesting way going forward about how we teach young people that are entering the workforce to build those managerial skills, the skills of in an office setting, those kinds of things that came inherently for us. We got dragged into the office 5 to 5 days a week.
Yeah.
When I started out anyway.
So how about your platform? Like, where do you see over the next couple of years, the innovation and opportunities to, with your roadmap, how are you guys going to innovate and what are you guys focused on?
So we're focused on, ironically, the stuff that I started out with, right? Building strategic procurement platforms. I know this sounds like a silly thing, right? But as you think about categories, for example, so let's say a management consulting is a category of spend. Some organizations spend literally hundreds and millions of dollars of management consulting per year. And today, that work is usually managed in a tool called Excel. And, you know, it's typically not a good place for it. So if you're going to spend $250 million on anything, you probably should manage it in a system to make sure you get the best outcome based for that money. So I see where Focal Point is going next is we already manage contract and send out RFPs and we manage the process and, you know, the projects and all those kinds of things, manage the suppliers. But what we're taking a step back and saying, let's say you're spending $250 million on something per year. You know your stakeholders, you know your suppliers, you know how quickly you pay them, you know how many projects there are. And then you say, all right, what is the external market landscape looks like? So what is my competitive levers that I can use to my advantage to get innovation, save money, those kinds of things. And using the internal landscape and the external landscape together will then help me build a proper strategy of how I can maximize my outcomes. And that's where I think AI will help significantly, right? So you can say to the context, you can use the context and say, all right, I'm spending this money. I have this many contracts. I have this many suppliers. Here's my concentration of spend. Here's my locations that I do business in. Now tell me, how should I go to market? How should I manage my suppliers? And how should I pay my suppliers? And that's really powerful stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that you have all that internal knowledge, as you talked about, and then you can leverage AI with the internal knowledge you've built up and external what's happening in the market and then collaborate on strategies to improve competitive advantage. And give it like another example of that. Like, what's like a practical use case of that?
A practical use case of that would be, okay, let's say you're managing janitorial services. Since I originally managed real estate, this is a real example, right? And you break down the cost of providing janitorial services. So what do you need, right? You need people, right? You need transportation, you need cleaning supplies, you need security. That's probably most of it, right? And as you look at the input components into a category, you can say, all right, my cost of labor just went up or down. Or my cost of, you can manage and monitor the input criteria and affects how that will look downstream for that. So then you can say, all right, so let's say now you're General Motors and the cost of steel just went up 10% or down 10%. How will that affect what I'm doing now? So should I buy, if you think the tariffs, for example, are going to increase my price of steel, does that mean I should buy some more steel now on futures? Or should I postpone something? Like, so it changes the dynamic of stuff, right? Because then you can look forward and say, you can run a whole list of inventories. So a lot of things have people, a lot of things have steel, a lot of things have aluminum, whatever the case may be, and start predicting what you should do based on the indicators in the market. And again, like that's really cool stuff, right? When you think
yeah.
about it.
So do you have, because that's like what CFOs, exec teams, and especially look at what's our expense structure, what's our risks,
Yeah.
how do we manage this going forward, how do we protect our margins or increase our margins? Like, are like CFOs and exec teams your customers now, or is that you're evolving to that, or?
We dip our toe in that water today, right? So we, when we look at things like accounts payables behavior, right? You wouldn't be shocked to learn that people tend to pay invoices as soon as they come in the door because accounts payable is driven by service, right? They want to get things paid out the door. And so let's say you spend a lot of money on a specific service and the money goes out the door in 2 days, you leave a lot of working capital on the table. So we tend to identify that to folks, right? Look, you're paying your invoices too soon. Just set it for 30 days and this is the working capital you free up. Then we take it to the next level to say, all right, in this category, and this traded available for this, right? You can say in this category, you're spending X million dollars. You're paying in 30 days, good job. The market bears 90 days. Right. And if you go from 30 to 90, here's a working capital that you're going to pick up on the balance sheet. And based on your WACC, this is the actual cost to you to do that. Like treasury people love that analysis, right? Because number one, it's easy and it's clear, but it's also relatively simple to implement.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of CFOs, not casting any aspersions, tend to look at accounts receivable rather than accounts payable.
That's a really good point. Yeah. A lot of people have business lines and interests and costs, and if you can improve your DSO collection of money and push out your payment of money, you have a lot, like you're talking about, a lot of working capital that the business can use to make money or reduce costs from these credit lines and stuff.
Exactly right. So again, it's like a tertiary service that we provide because we're really a procurement tool, but we have all this intel.
Yeah.
And if you look at global companies, for example, like in Europe, for example, paying late is frowned upon, especially for small businesses, right? But within our solution, we can say, all right, here's a list of small businesses. You can pay them in 30 days and you can pay a top five consulting firm in 90 days if that's what the market will bear. And you can stratify, you can still meet your regulatory compliance, but also save working capital where you can't, right?
Yeah.
And typically that takes a lot of manual work to figure that out. And now since you have all the data and you can deploy agents to ferret all those things out for you,
it's pretty powerful.
Pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, and then the world just keeps getting more and more, maybe bureaucratic, but just regulation. It's unbelievable. Like, I run a tech company, and it's unbelievable for large and small deals how much we have to sign our life away and ensure compliance with everything. And I guess you guys help automate some of that. Yeah, because
100%, right? So,
these questionnaires and these forms are like ridiculous.
Yeah, and again, I think I love CISOs and I love regulators and those kinds of folks, right? They keep us all employed to some extent. But I think the pendulum has swung too far. And so if someone's delivering pizza to your front office, don't send them a sock too, right? It doesn't apply in this scenario. And I think we need to figure out like what due diligence do we actually need to do with the supplier based on the services they're providing to a customer, right? Rather than using it as a blunt instrument. And so we go through a lot with our customers to say, look, who are you regulated by? Let's start there, because that's important, right? If you're regulated by the FDA or the OCC or the Federal Reserve Bank, yeah, you've been held to task for sure. But if you're not regulated, what's good business practice, right? So if they don't get your data, if they're not part of the customer journey, if they don't come on site, like don't throw the book at them. Just scale it down some. So so the amount of due diligence is commensurate to the exposure that you have. And I think that's the first starting point you can have. But also as we start looking at ways to improve that experience, like we're piloting now the idea of rather than sending out this questionnaire for everyone to answer, the first thing you can do is upload your SOC 2. And then we can parse that document and probably answer 80% of those questions right from the SOC 2.
That'd be amazing. That would be amazing.
Right. But it's all there, right? Especially with a SOC 2, the security criteria are so simple spelled out. They're even numbered for you, right? And so if you meet all these service criteria, you're probably good to go for a lot of things, right? And again, unfortunately, a lot of people don't care about the supplier's experience. They care about the internal experience. We look at it both ways. How many tokens do you really need to parse a SOC 2? Probably not that many. And it sure will be a popular thing if, for your suppliers as well.
Yeah, 100% be popular for them. You might be able to get some licensing fees from them just to reduce that burden. It's a real burden out there.
For sure. Yeah. So all I'm saying is this, right? This is a target-rich area, as I would say, right? There are so many processes that can be improved by putting in automation where people are spending a lot of time just quite honestly right now just using ChatGPT to answer the questions anyway, right?
Yeah,
But if you
no
actually
doubt.
take a document like a SOC 2, which has some teeth behind it because it's been audited by somebody else, it's probably not a bad way of going.
It's a good idea. Now, what question didn't I ask that you wish that maybe you wish I would have asked?
Maybe about hesitancy to adopt AI, because it's interesting. So Europeans in particular, at least certainly from our perspective, is are sort of laggards in this space. So we're talking to a very large bank based in Europe who have now basically set up defensive positions. Their IT departments have set up defensive positions to say, if you've been bringing in a new application, the first thing you need to do is make a build versus buy analysis, which is like way back. Remember 10 years ago when the cloud came, right? And people were terrified of putting stuff in the cloud. That's happening again now with AI. And so the first thing you have to do is do this build versus buy because they do not want any AI to be part of anything that's touching their data. And it's a lot of scary sort of regulatory things happening in Europe. But the good news about Europe is at least they have agreed on a common sort of nomenclature management structure for their use of AI. If you look at Asia, every country has their, and it's becoming this very disjointed way of regulations because we haven't picked a standard yet. And I think what's going to happen in the future is whoever has the most strict standards will rule the roost. Right? And I think right now the Europeans are leading that charge with the AI regulation that just came out. So I think once we get clarity around how to stratify the risk of using AI, I think it's going to be much better and easier for everybody.
When you say rule the roost, you mean, yeah, that everyone will build their systems to adhere to that regulation, and then all other regulations will then just be working because it'll be a subset of that.
Correct, exactly. And if you look at how the Europeans, I can't recite it off the top of my head, right? But they have four levels of sort of risk in AI, and the vast majority of them sit at the bottom. And then you say, will you be sort of predicting the behavior of individuals? Okay, that's one. Or will you be making decisions based? It's like steps up relatively quickly. But I think, again, like that's a framework that people can look at and say, yeah, I can follow that.
And I wonder, do you have any insight into when you think this will settle down?
Yeah, we can't even get bills passed in Washington. It's kind of hard to sort of make any predictions around that. But again, like cloud computing now is here to stay. It took 10 years probably to get there. I don't think it will take that long with AI.
Yeah, and it does get more complex too when, you know, the vision of everyone having agentic execution and agents talking to agents. And we all know AI, you can't trust it because it's not always accurate, but it seems pretty confident. Or if it's agentic, it's just going to execute and do it. And yeah, I don't know. We have a long ways to go with the tech.
I think we are one huge disaster away from opening our eyes to that, right? So if somebody puts a trading platform in that the agents just make the trades and you know, go off the rails and somebody loses their company because of it, I think then people are going to say, oh crap, we could have seen that coming, right? But something's going to happen.
Yeah, a lot of people are just moving so fast to leverage AI because they're being pressured from the top. But there's a lot of things to worry about, a lot of things that are amazing and to leverage to improve execution and automation. And but yeah, a lot to worry about.
Yep. And again, like I think it's a target-rich environment, right? So let's start with the simple stuff and get really good at that. And then you can build your way up to the hard stuff. And I think I'm a conservative feller, not starting my own company, notwithstanding. So I want to see it work before I deploy it across. And that's
Yeah.
probably not bad advice.
But that's really good advice, actually. Just pragmatic, and it is good advice for not just procurement, but for everything in building systems or deploying systems and utilizing AI. Just being pragmatic, testing it, seeing what it really can and can't do. Yeah, great. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Yeah, so you can look me up on LinkedIn. I post fairly regularly. My name is Anders, Anders, last name Lillevik. If you want to check out Focal Point, our website address is getfocalpoint.com. focalpoint.com. And yeah, I'm a relatively easy guy to find, I think.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you, Anders, for sharing your point of view, and keep building out a good platform. Good luck.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.